Welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. For a very long time, the unique needs of homeless youth have been near the bottom of the list. Often marginalized and viewed by society as less worthy of help, teens have been left to fend for themselves in malls, beaches, and wherever they think they can momentarily be safe. Often that does not mean a shelter where they can spend the night. There aren't any youth-only overnight shelters. Youth are vulnerable and frequently incompatible with homeless adults, so teens usually prefer to just be with other teens someplace else. I met up with Carla Hauser, the program manager for the Youth Outreach Program. It's a collaboration of Waikiki Health and Halekipa. We talked about the status of homeless youth and whether there's more movement now to focus on them in the same way chronic homeless people and veterans have been targeted for help.
I think we're getting there. There has been a coordinated effort by the youth service providers to come to the table and actually come up with how are we going to provide one of the most basic essential needs for these kids, which is housing. And, you know, with that housing, there has to be support. These kids are they're developmentally different than adults. So you can't just throw them into an apartment and say, good luck, we've rapidly rehoused you. Now do all the things like pay your rent and work with your landlord, things like that. That just doesn't happen with this particular age group.
You're talking about life skills that they've never been trained to know how to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And then also to be able to start addressing some of their substance abuse issues, some of the mental illness that's starting to set in, starting to address the trauma that they've experienced. As far as I'm concerned, there really isn't a safe level of homelessness for children or young adults and adolescents. And so that really is the direction that we need to go to address the things that they've experienced.
We're often told that homeless youth are actually a compilation of various different ages. Their chronological age, mm-hmm. their experiential age, and the age of their trauma, mm-hmm. too. So that's given them experiences that nobody should have had, and then their very real experiences of being just a kid, as well as how old they really are. All of that wrapped up into one person. Mm-hmm. You're also talking about people who are minors. When you look at that whole picture of someone, are we expecting too much of them in the various systems that we have now? And you just talked about, you know, just throwing them into an apartment and saying, well, here you go, you've been now housed.
Right. And where they are developmentally, when you think about your typical teenager who, in comparison to their housed peers, it's their job at this age to not trust adults. It's their job to make mistakes, figure things out, not really like authority. That's where they are developmentally. And so when you're taking a kid who it's safer for them to be in the streets than it is in the home. So they form their own little hui's and their own communities. And sometimes that has a good experience and sometimes not so much. And so you have to kind of work with them, allow them to make mistakes. It's something that we do at Yo. It's this whole idea of unconditional positive regard. So if a kid comes in and, you know, we know that they, you know, stole somebody's wallet, you welcome them back the next day. Hey, it's really good to see you. Now let's sit down and kind of have a conversation about what happened yesterday. We don't want to push them away. So if you mess up in a positive youth development model, if you mess up, the last thing we want to do is punish them. We don't want to send them further away from us, which so often happens. In your school system, a kid messes up, they get in a fight. What's the first thing we do? We expel kids. We push them away from these support systems that are supposed to teach them and what's right and what's wrong. What we try to do is bring them even closer. So you mess up, now you get to sit down with us, we get to have a conversation, we get to talk about, like, how do we de-escalate, how do we work through some of these issues. So, you know, just a different approach to working with kids.
I hear you say that there has to be a program that becomes bridges to a developmental age, to an experiential age, mm-hmm. and their trauma age.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So that there's a sense that they're looked at very differently by those who deal with youth, mm-hmm. but not looked at differently by those who are in some ways creating the stream of funding or the stream of expectations for how we deal with homeless youth.
Mm-hmm. If the ultimate outcome is that this youth is going to have to be successful in an apartment by themselves with a little bit of case management here or there, our outcomes are not going to be great. It's what other support services are we able to link? Just the fact that we can get a youth who's been traumatized by other adults, just the fact that we can get them to come in and engage with us, just to acknowledge an adult that trust, you know, and build that relationship, now we're on to something. And that's why I think part of it is it has been really hard to actually show where we are with youth homelessness. They're also not the guys pushing shopping carts down the street. You go to the malls, you go to any of the beaches in Waikiki, you're running into homeless youth. We see over 500 kids a year walk through our door. So they're out there and they're hard to count, they're hard to see. And so if you imagine if you're an outreach worker and you're trying to go out into the community and find kids, you just don't walk up to a kid and say, hey, by the way, are you homeless? Would you like a sandwich? There's so much more that has to go into that. When we look for funding, when we, you know, we ask the state for outreach dollars, there's a process to it. And I don't think a lot of people are really patient with the process with youth.
Is the state patient with the process? And does the state understand this in the way that you would like them to?
I think we're getting there. We are absolutely getting there. The fact that when we sit down at a table and with all of the youth providers and we have a representative from the governor's office, that to me shows that they're present, they're listening, and they understand. Scott Morishige, he can be very polarizing one way or another, but Scott knows the names of every single one of our homeless kids in certain encampments. He's a social worker at heart, and he's in a really tough position. He is constantly coming to us and saying, hey, what do you know about this kid? What can we do, you know, with this family? So I think the state is very aware of what we're dealing with. And it's because he is out there when he goes out into the encampments. He's learning their names. And that, to me, is a real kind of human approach.
So, Carla, how would you like to point people to understanding this better and being able to be helpful in this way as we're seeing more people becoming really agitated about the homelessness issue, is how people characterize it? Mm-hmm. We're talking about people, and in this case, we're talking about kids.
Mm-hmm. I've actually fielded phone calls when people, oh, we want to help, you know, children, youth outreach. So they call and they want to donate. And when I explain a little bit about the program that, you know, we work with teens and young adults, and oh, those kids, they just need to get a job and they won't be homeless anymore. And if only it were that simple. A lot of our kids hold down jobs and they experience things that a normal 40-year-old would curl up in a little ball, and yet they get up every single day and they keep going and they keep going. And there's this level of resiliency. The thing that very much, I think, separates our young people from some of our older adults is these young kids still have hope despite everything else that they've experienced, you know, all of the adults that have kind of done really terrible things to them. They still have hope that their life is going to be different. And I think that's the main piece that people have to understand, is that these kids are resilient and they're hopeful and they're really awesome, awesome young people.
But they do need help.
Yes, absolutely.
They're not going to be able to simply live on the hope. But one of the blessings of youth is the fact that they have that still intact.
Yes.
So bottom line, what do you think needs to happen for homeless youth in the next 6 months or year? What do you think is the very next step that's absolutely a must?
One area that we're working on is kind of as a collective group coming up with, you know, our inventory. What do we have currently out there that's housing that's specific for our young people? Whether it's transitional living, is it an emergency shelter? You know, our youth are not doing well when we place them at the adult shelters. They're just not. They don't want to be around adults in that kind of situation.
In the other situation, many people would be telling them that's not appropriate for them to be around
exactly
that group of people who are adults in that way.
Mm-hmm. And so currently we're starting to bring some of the big time, we're starting to bring the silos together. So that's working with child welfare, that's working with the DOE, and bringing everybody to the table to say, how do we address this? Not just from the drop-in center or a little bit of street outreach, but there are so many institutions that can come together and work collectively. That's the direction that we're going. I'm hopeful. Because we have a lot of great kids who deserve an opportunity.
Carla Hauser is the program manager for the Youth Outreach Program. It's a collaboration of Waikiki Health and Halekipa. YO, as it's known, provides medical care and social service support at a drop-in center located in Waikiki. The YO program also conducts street outreach and meets youth just where they are.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, locations, Noheia Gallery, and Straub Medical Center.
Hi, this is Sarah Bauer, HPR's Sustaining Membership Coordinator. I'm excited to share with you a special opportunity we have on August 1st. It's our first $10 Tuesday. If HPR's music, entertainment, news, and information have become an important part of your life, this is your day to act. Become a sustaining member on $10 Tuesday at $10 a month, and you'll find your member-supported radio sounding even sweeter.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, we'll take another look at what's happening with the National Association of Counties Conference. But first, your backyard quiz. Like much in Hawaii, the Hawaiian cowboy's origins are from the mainland, imported from Spanish and Mexican Alta California in the 1800s. Soon, more Paniolos were homegrown in the Hawaiian Islands. Many of them proved to be exceptional athletes, horse handlers, and cattlemen. Even Rawhide Ben Lowe, owner and manager of Pu'ava'ava Ranch, knew this and sent three of his ranch hands to the 1908 Frontier Days celebration in Cheyenne, Wyoming. The three men made a colorful entrance, wearing their vaquero-inspired chaps and hats topped with flower lei. In the World Championship finals of the competitions, one of Even's men took home the win in the steer roping contest, completing it in just 56 seconds and making history at the same time. Our question to you today is, what was the name of this famous Paniolo who schooled those mainland cowboys? Call us at 941-3689 or at 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one with the correct one gets our reusable tote bag that tells everyone you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, a private school for girls in grades preschool through high school, where the focus is on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
County governments have a different relationship with their residents. It's often more accessible and personal. or so believe many of the county representatives who regularly attend the meetings of the National Association of Counties. The latest conference was this week. Maui Council Member Ricky Hokama was there. We talked shortly after he got off the plane about the conversation over health care and other policies that filled the week.
Well, at the national conference, we talk about this at least three times a year. On a bigger picture, I would say for counties in general, 3,069 across the country, it is not a partisan issue. While we are very political people, counties do not see health as a partisan issue. For us, it's about fulfilling county responsibility that required by our charters to ensure public health and safety services for our most vulnerable residents. And for counties, it's our kids, our kupunas, and of those people that has challenges or disabilities.
Having said that, and then, how does that fit with what you see happening on a national scale?
Well, you know, I see a lot of personalities being involved. I wish the president would come up more with a position paper than just give us 15, 30-second tweets about what his thoughts are. You know, for us, the debate should be about improving the health outcomes. It shouldn't just be about a budget exercise or a dollar amount. As a country, we should be talking about outcomes regarding our nation's health and how does it impact us regarding economic development and the ability to finance those programs to take care of those that are in need. Congress seems to be orchestrating through this health discussion for people like me at the local level a massive cost shift that is currently beyond the capacity of not only the counties, but in my opinion, beyond capacity of even our state.
And we've been told that a lot, especially as it regards the Medicaid program. How then do you see what the counties can do at that very local level where you're more apt to be able to see people who are dramatically affected by it?
You're very knowledgeable, and thank you for coming across there, because I appreciate you asking these very hard questions. For the counties, and, you know, while Hawaii has, we've adjusted since the late 50s and under the late Governor Burns with his centralized views of how healthcare and education should be in the state of Hawaii for quality and as well as fairness, counties in the United States annually invest over $80 billion in community healthcare. And for overall averages, that's about one of every $5 in county budgets across the country that puts forth in the community health program.
Does that include Maui?
For us, we put in monies, but under the state of Hawaii, the health department, and by through our state constitution, is the assigned responsible agency to move this forward. Prior to, I would say, Governor Burns making the change, every county in Hawaii care of their own schools and their own hospitals. And that's why in the past it was called the county hospitals and King State County hospitals. And now we're veering off to, now we're going into a form of variation of privatization. Our county support over 1,000 hospitals in the country, which is about two-thirds, which are located in rural and small communities. That's where the biggest long-term impacts are currently being held, as well as about 1,000 long-term care facilities. And of that, over half of that is in rural America and small counties. So for people like me who comes from it's interesting, we think we're small, but people look at us, they come from populations of like 5,000 people counties. There's a county in California, Alpine, 1,200 people, that's the whole county. Loving, Texas, 71 people is the whole county. Compared to your LA County, 10 million, Cook County, Illinois, 9 million, San Diego, 9 million.
Which makes it kind of tough to be able to talk about county issues when you see that there's such a disparity in their size. But for Maui County, what did you take away as you're looking at, you know, the county that you know and that you've got control in many cases over the purse strings and the budget? What did you take away from this meeting that might show up in the way Maui County is governed? And certainly, as you brought up the issue with the public-private partnership with Kaiser and the hospitals on Maui, that might feel an impact from what you've learned.
I would say from my experience and how it affects Maui County, especially with myself coming from Lanai and having Lanai Community Hospital under the Maui County umbrella with Maui Memorial and Hula Hospital, what I've come is that the state, our state, really needs to relook and understand the language that people like me, as one of the delegates in 1978, expected the state to be the lead and responsible agency. And that's why earlier I brought up a point of that this should be about what is the health outcomes the people of Hawaii want, and not just be a budgetary decision where the state decided we don't want to fund this, we don't want to raise revenues, whether it be through taxes or anything else, to do what I feel is a governmental responsibility to all residents, especially Maui County.
Is there anything that you can see that from your meeting with the counties this time around might change the conversation as you come back to Maui and you look at a lot of the treatment programs, the fact that we have an opioid epidemic? Very clearly, we've been watching mental health services increase, for example, under the ACA. That might change, were the situation to change for that.
Mm-hmm.
And that confluence of, or at least the nexus of, mental health services and substance abuse, not looking at them, you know, separately, but being able to look at them together, which is the way a lot of treatment centers look at them. And this isn't even going into issues about homelessness that feeds into that, too. But was there anything?
Early childhood development. You
yeah.
got it.
And anything in the conversation that you heard this time around, given the national climate and the conversation, the narrative that we're hearing coming out of Washington, anything that you took away that would change how you might look at Maui and what you might like to do?
I'm convinced that what our county is doing is the correct thing to do. But what gets me excited, and I appreciate that this question is, I am looking forward to the question that the people of Hawaii will be asked next year, is whether or not we should have another constitutional convention. And I think that would be a great forum to refocus governance in Hawaii and figure out what level of governance should be the appropriate level to take care of a lot of our major issues.
While you're talking about that, can I ask you about the issue of having a county manager? Because that has come up in Maui several times. You've had conversations. As you have talked to many counties who have that form of governance, has there been any further conversation about that relative to what you might like to see happen on Maui?
Well, I'm going to be upfront. I do not support a county manager's position. I believe that the people should be able to elect on top of their government structure. I expect a county managing director with appropriate, and that's what I have a push for. And finally, in the charter, we have the council giving reviewing confirmation for those top department heads and appointees. And that is a proper way to vet and ensure we have the right people with experience and understanding. Yeah, I still believe that in the traditional form of governance and under federalism of how we started, of what the federal, state, and the local government should be, it was very clear and simple through the scores of years. I think we've kind of diluted the clarity, and by making it more complex, have diluted that level of who is governing for what purposes. I think in the state of Hawaii, there's a clear misunderstanding of what is county and what is state, especially in the area of taxation and finance. And that's why, you know, I'm going to push for the CONCON, and I believe that the counties, through their charters, should be speaking as the key governance documents.
Well, then I look forward to another conversation we can talk about that. Thank you so much for the time today.
Thank you for allowing me to share my thoughts.
Riki Hokama represents the Lanai Residency Area on the Maui County Council and chairs the Budget and Finance Committee. He just returned from the Conference of National Association of Counties. The case of the Hawaii soldier accused of trying to support the Islamic State may not be the only thing on trial. It's also focusing attention on how the military handles mental illness. Civil Beat reporter Kirsten Downey has the reality check. Hi, Kirsten.
Aloha, Bethann.
So are we really looking at a situation where we've got mental health square and front of us, and the fact that this is dealing with a terrorism issue, almost not secondary, but one that is working in tandem with this issue of whether there's mental illness?
Well, but then one of the issues we have here is that not all the facts are out yet. This is still very early in the prosecution of this case. But what we do know is that Ikaika Kang was showing some very odd behavior in the few years before the events happened in which led to him being accused of being a sympathizer of the Islamic State and of trying to actually help ISIS defeat the United States. He had made threatening statements. He had made a lot of pro-ISIS statements. But his attorney, Bernie Brevard, is going to be asking for a full mental health evaluation as to what was actually going on psychologically with Mr. Kang during these years leading up to the actual events in which he appeared to be trying to assist ISIS.
That was something he said a few weeks ago when all of this came to light. We've also talked to Dr. Jim Spira, who was the former director of the Department of Veteran Affairs National Center for PTSD. And he says that there are real signs, as you mentioned, that it wasn't necessarily or isn't necessarily a case of just PTSD, but that might be the knee-jerk reaction. Did you have anyone tell you that, you know, this needs to be looked at not just through the lens of PTSD, but just mental illness itself?
I think that has been raised by a number of people, whether there was an underlying mental health condition. But certainly very many soldiers who have been deployed to the Middle East have returned very ill with PTSD. In fact, it's estimated that 11 to 20% of American soldiers who've served there between 2001 and 2014 have from time to time or continuously symptoms of PTSD. And in fact, we now have almost a million veterans in America with PTSD. So regardless of what other underlying mental health issues may be revealed in the course of the psychological examination, there is at least a risk that PTSD is a factor that worsened his condition.
Which kind of goes back to the whole idea of if this behavior was being evidenced while he was in the military, who really wasn't paying attention? And I guess we'll have to leave it there.
Well, that is one of the things that the Army will be needing to look at very carefully, and the General Accounting Office has already raised some red flags about the failures of the Army to really look out for who is showing signs of mental illness and getting them into care.
Going to be a very interesting case on lots of levels. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Kirsten Downey. It's a Friday, and as we always like to do, we're taking a look at what our news department is working on that we will be hearing in the coming week. To help us with that is HPR's news director, Bill Dorman. And I guess we're starting off with, as you characterized it, a little bit of a family fight. We'll see what the GOP says about that.
Yes, aloha, Bethann. You know, all kinds of communities here in the islands, all kinds of iterations of Ohana, and sometimes that can be a bit combative as well. And into that category, these days, you would want to insert the Hawaii Republican Party. 6 months away now from the date for candidate sign-up for the 2018 primary election, and there is, as you say, to put it mildly, a bit of a split within the Republican Party. They're going to be talking. They're going to be talking over the weekend, party leadership and influentials getting together this weekend in Waikiki. When Yoshioka is going to check in, sort of put the finger to the wind, see what the latest is, and he'll bring us back some details next week on that.
To be a fly on that wall this
exactly.
weekend.
Exactly.
We're also talking about homelessness, and we've been talking about that for a very long time periodically, but we're going to hear from Sherry Bracken, I understand.
Yeah, again, you know, a lot of times, and we talked about this before, the discussion of homelessness sometimes focuses on this island, on Oahu. Part of that is because of numbers and attention, visibility in some ways. But, of course, it's different on each island and in different parts of different islands. And next week, we're going to be seeing a bit more about the west side of Hawaii Island these days. And as we know, there's going to be sweep scheduled out by the old Kona Airport. And you'll have...
we'll be talking about that next week on The Conversation, too.
Exactly, exactly. And so Sherry's going to help round out our coverage on that in terms of, again, not just sort of officialdom and here we go. What happens if you are cited, you're asked to show up in court, you have to go 10 miles away, and you have no way of getting there?
It'll be a good story. We're going to listen to that from Sherry next week. But while we're talking about the neighbor islands, what about a story of development, or maybe not a story about development?
Exactly. You could call this development delayed, if not development denied.
Interrupted or something.
Yes, exactly. So South Maui, North Kihei, an area that's seen a lot of changes over the years, as you know. Back in 2013, there was a proposal for this massive retail space, the mega malls, they called it. It would have been 700,000 square feet. State Land Use Commission said no. A revised version coming back this month, smaller footprint, including some apartments. Land Use Commission again said no. But the story's not over. Kalina Wechi of the Maui News is going to be telling us what's next.
Okay, before you go, we're going to have a story about tats in Honolulu.
Time for the Pacific Ink and Art Expo. Kuvehi Hiraishi is going to be all over that.
All right. Well, hopefully it won't be all over her, too, when she comes back. Thanks very much.
You bet.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. As you know, if you listen to this program every week, on Fridays we check out your letters and email. Following Tuesday's interview with Dr. Willie Parker, Mimi in Honolulu wrote us and said, "Loved your interview with a pro-choice Christian doctor today. How refreshing to hear a positive story about women's health and the need for choice." After last week's town square on the Marco Polo condo fire, Eddie Arva said this via Facebook, "How could you possibly condone not having sprinklers in any high-rise? I understand it was built in the 70s, but you sure as something know that the pool and many of the other amenities were added and updated since then. It's called maintenance fees. All condo owners pay them. An amazing individual and his family would still be here today if that building had them." And Kavika Luna said, "This is like asking, should owners of cars pay for working brake lights?" Thank you all for the feedback. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call the Talkback line, that's 792-8217.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
South Korea is one of the most wired countries in the world. It's also home to some of the world's leading technology companies and where some of the newest tech products are field-tested. Kwon Min Lee set up the new user experience group at Samsung. He's in Hawaii this week as part of a conference wrapping up today at the UH Center for Korean Studies, which may give a glimpse into our technology future. He spoke with HPR's Noe Tanigawa about the creative process behind the products.
The Creative Lab at Samsung was a unique organization in that once the employees of Samsung, if they get selected, to work at Creative Lab, then they were not assigned any regular company works. Employees got assigned to the Creative Lab, and their job are just focus on new services and designs and new products. So These Creative Lab members, they were separate from their usual organizations, and they focus on new innovations.
Kwan, your field, what would you call your field of work?
My area is, the big name for my area is human-computer interaction. So human-computer interaction is a multidisciplinary field. It's partly computer science, partly social science, and also it also involves the elements of design. So in my field, we in academia, we conduct studies about how people interact with machines, computers, and new technology devices.
Is there any particular reason that Koreans, I mean, do Koreans have an edge on this type of study?
Yeah, many young Korean people, they want to major in this kind of human-computer interaction and interaction science. But HCI as an academic field come from United States. So in United States, it's much more popular than in Korea, because in Korea, after this academic establishment of the field in United States, Korea has imported this academic field. And then in Korea, we kind of changed this academic field so that it can have more practical applications. So many good universities in South Korea, we provide major related to human-computer interaction. But unlike United States, we emphasize more on this application side so that these students, when they major this interaction science or human-computer interaction, they are more likely to work closely with electronics companies such as Samsung and LG. And also they work together with game companies like NCSoft and also these car companies like Hyundai Motors.
That is so fascinating. What kinds of products are the cutting edge now, Kwan?
I mean the,
in Korea?
It's in terms of IT, Korea is pretty much testbed. So Samsung, LG, and other IT companies in Korea, they come up with these ideas for new devices, and then they make a kind of prototype devices in South Korea, and then they just let the Korean customers first use it, and if it works well, then they kind of roll out this product to the world. So right now in Korea, there are so many different smartphones. So Samsung and LG, they work together with telecommunication carrier. So they provide different options, different styles of smartphones to this telecommunication carrier. So, I mean, the customers in United States, they are very familiar with this timeline Galaxy series, such as Galaxy S8. But other than Galaxy S8, there are so many different Galaxy smartphones in Korea. Usually, Galaxy S8 is the top of the line, but there are many cheaper version of Galaxy. So that teenagers or young people can, if they cannot afford Galaxy S8, then they will go for this cheaper option. In the cheaper option lines, there are many variations. So customers can just select smartphones that provide more battery life. Or customers can just select the smartphones that provide this huge screen. So they have their many different choices.
What will the next generation of innovations in phones be? What more can you do with a phone? It just gets bigger and smaller. That's it, right?
Very important. This artificial intelligence, these conversation partners, Siri, Bixby, Alexa. So this AI-based agent will be very important in smartphone. And also the integration of a smartphone with a smart car, that will be the big issue in the future. So how are we going to make a seamless integration of smartphone and smart cars so that the information, entertainment that people have on their smartphones can seamlessly go to a smart car so that the customers can enjoy the seamless access to their information and entertainment wherever they go. So that will be the big issue in future.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Regardless of Apple, regardless of companies, consumers expect that smartphones have this kind of shape, smartphone has this kind of interface. So in terms of the innovation in smartphones, it'll be incremental. But in terms of innovation in smart car, it'll be disruptive. So in a smart car innovation, probably 5 or 6 years from now, we'll see totally different ways of driving your car. We'll see totally different ways of using your car. So I see that for the next 5 or 6 years, the biggest changes will come in smart car sector.
Well, gee, Dr. Lee, thank you so much for your time and your thoughts.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Mine too. Aloha.
Kwan Min Lee is part of a conference this week at the UH Center for Korean Studies. And you can find out more information on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Inter-Island Solar Supply, Kaiser Permanente, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
And now we're going to get back to today's backyard quiz. We got in touch with our inner cowboy earlier today. We revisited the 1908 Frontier Day celebration in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Here, our Hawaiian paniolos exhibited their skill in steer roping. Until 1908, Wyoming American cowboys had taken the championship every single year, but that was about to change. Even ranch hands Archie Ka'aoa came in second, and Jack Lowe, despite suffering an asthma attack during the competition, placed sixth. But with the time to beat of 56 seconds, legendary paniola Ikua Purdy won the steer roping competition by a landslide, and Hawaii's paniola proved their worth. In 1999, Purdy was also voted into the National Rodeo Cowboy Hall of Fame, the first ever Hawaiian to be nominated. That's today's quiz, and Cindy Lawrence from Kula called us. She is our winner, but she also told us a story about the song Wyomina, and I think we have some of that to play for you by Napalapalai as we go out of our backyard quiz.
Aloha, this is Elizabeth Jensen. I'm NPR's ombudswoman. If you want to listen back to a show, visit The Conversation at hawaiipublicradio.org.
In Washington, the Smithsonian Asian American Literature Festival will be wrapping up a week that's part incubator, part showcase, and part cooperative space. For some Hawaii writers, it marks a new benchmark in the appreciation of the Hawaii immigrant experience. Among them is Bamboo Ridge writer Christy Passion. She's the winner of the 2017 CADES Award for Emerging Writer. She co-authored No Choice But to Follow and co-author the docu-wrenchy, What We Must remember, based on the infamous 1932 Massey trial. Christy Passion is on the line with us now from Washington. Hi, Christy.
Aloha.
And congratulations on many levels.
Thank you, yes.
This seems to be a seminal point in not only your career, but in that of many of the Hawaii writers who are joining you. Why is it that point for you?
I'm sorry, Bethan, could you repeat that one more time?
Sure. I'm just saying that it seems as if for you and the writers that have journeyed from Hawaii, that this is really a seminal point in your careers.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering for you, what makes it so?
A couple of things, and we're thinking on this as we did our panel discussion today about being from Hawaii and coming all the way out here to our nation's capital. For me, on a personal level, my grandfather was an immigrant in the sugarcane field. And my father got his high school diploma and stressed education, and here is his daughter now at the Smithsonian telling our family stories. And for me, the trajectory is just so humbling. And then on a different level, on a broader level, Bamboo Ridge itself is one of those immigrant stories of being just scrappy and sticking in there, and that it was founded to have a place for Hawaii's voices, that our stories and the way we talk and the language we use has meaning. And, you know, it's stuck in there, it's held on, it's flourished, and now it's being recognized at this level. And it really is really kind of it's a wonderful experience and also very humbling at the same time.
For many years, so many of those stories were marginalized and weren't regarded in the same way that you're finding that they're being appreciated now in Washington. Where do you
Yes.
think writers from Hawaii, particularly those like you who have been so deeply wrapped in family history and lore, where do you think writers go from that point when they're trying to approach what you've already accomplished?
If I'm understanding correctly, are you saying where do Hawaii writers go with their particular stories?
Well, you've already sort of tread the path, and you've been able to get to a place that writers in Hawaii, some of them would like to, and they feel very often that they have similar stories that would be of equal import, but how to
yeah.
be able to get them to the place where other people also see value in them is part craft and part luck and also having, you know, a really good way of being able to distribute it and having people take notice. What have
yeah.
you learned in the incubator part of the festival this time?
We are coming together as we're noticed when we've come here to this festival. It is also Bamboo Ridge Press, but also Kaya Press and Kundiman, which are these small presses that are definitely dedicated to the marginalized voice. I think for writers in Hawaii who have stories to tell, the world is opening up to recognizing our voices and actually seeking out and wanting our voices. Hence, these bigger opportunities are coming. I say to them, keep up your writing. I say to them, you know, the story does matter. Work on your craft, but like any writer of any genre, a dedication and perseverance is everything. You cannot just write a story, and if it gets rejected, just go home and say, well, I gave it my best. It requires constant repolishing, constantly trying, and also finding a writing community. For me, it was Bamboo Ridge, and once you find that and you find people who can work with you, you will continue. If you commit to it, it's ready to be heard.
What would you offer in not just advice, but in approach to how these stories are told in ways that maybe we haven't seen? We've had some, you know, really successful stories that have come out of the Asian American community, but in looking at refining it and getting it down to some of the levels that you see these stories now emerging, what do you say to writers in how they approach their stories?
Authenticity. That is the key. You know, I think people will look at a mainland formula or see books in a certain style and emulate. And in that, you lose everything that's authentic about where we're from, about what your particular story is. I think you have to hold true to your guns, speak in your language, say it the way you are, and always refine, yes, of course, but I think it's authenticity what people are desiring. Once you lose that, and once you give away that piece, be it how you speak, be it the subject matter that you're speaking of that's important to you, be it the names that you use, I think then you just become a voice in the crowd.
Are we at a new level of, or at least a new era of Asian American literature?
I'm not sure if we're at a new era or if we're just finally opening up to what has always been there. I think in regards to maybe publishing being accepting of different perspectives and different experiences, you know, that the China fiction right now is just exploding everywhere you're looking. I think that we are more open as a nation. We're actually maybe catching up to Hawaii, where Hawaii has always recognized all these different, all of our different counterparts. And understood those voices and welcomed those voices. We're never afraid of those voices. Maybe the U.S. is finally catching up to us.
It's been just a delight talking to you. I hope that you have a wonderful trip coming back, and you've got one more day to go of the conference.
Yes.
And
thank you so much. Yeah.
Very good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. Thank you, Bethan.
Christy Passion is a critical care nurse at the Queen's Medical Center, but she's also the winner of the 2017 CADES Award for Emerging Writer. She co-authored No Choice But to Follow and co-authored What We Must Remember, a documentary centered on the infamous 1932 Massey trial. She's in Washington at the Smithsonian Asian American Literature Festival, wrapping up tomorrow.
Aloha, I'm Jude Hill from Kailua. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
I'm Stephen Dubner on the next Freakonomics Radio. Good intentions are nice, but when it comes to social programs, wouldn't it be even nicer to know what actually works?
People just assume that if you do something that sounds good, that it's going to have positive effects, but it's actually more complicated than that.
When Helping Hurts, that's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Sunday morning at 11.
Thank you all so much for joining us for The Conversation. That's going to do it for us for this week. Coming on Monday, among other issues, we'll be looking at what's happening in the travel ban saga with the Diversity Visa Lottery. Immigration attorney Claire Hanyus will be here. Now, in the meantime, if you'd like to be in touch with us, there are lots of ways for you to do that, and we'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. The number is 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And if you like social media, we're there too. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR if you want to get a hold of me. To hear The Conversation or many of the shows that we air, you can find them all on the new HPR app. You can search for HPR in the Apple Store or on Google Play. Lillian Song produces our program, and Ryan Finnerty and Amber Kahn are our production assistants. The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll be back here on Monday when we pick up The Conversation.